you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 161 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host, as usual, playing a little bit hurt today. I've been gallivanting all around Europe. I know it's a hard life I live, but I was lucky enough to spend a few days on a Viking river cruise up the Rhine and ended up in Amsterdam for a couple more days. And I spent most of that time running my immune system down to the point that I got really sick on the way home. So mission accomplished. But in any case, I'm here with you today. And today my guest is Melissa Fikak. Now, Melissa is a family law attorney out of South Jersey, southern part of New Jersey. And you're going to hear an interesting story how she went through a number of different careers, much the same as I did, before she entered into practice of law and settled in the family law area, where she focuses primarily on offering services in her area involving mediation and collaborative law. She also does litigation, but she focused primarily in mediation and family law and is expanding that area of her practice. And it presents some unique challenges, unique opportunities. And I think you'll find our discussion to be kind of interesting in that regard. And I hope you enjoy listening to my friend, Melissa Fikak. Melissa Fikak, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Oh, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm very happy to have a fellow New Jerseyan, although I don't know that I can claim my roots anymore to the state of New Jersey, but there was a long period of time where I was a New Jerseyan. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. So I came about being a family attorney a little differently. I've been practicing family law now for about 19 years. But when I graduated high school, I actually went to the Fashion Institute of Technology. And there I got my bachelor's degree in toy design. So it's very different to be in family law from toy design. It was one of those things where I graduated from the toy program, and at that same time, Mattel and Hasbro, which were the number one and number two toy companies, bought just about every other company that was in the top 10, and displaced a lot of people that were looking for, you know, now employment. And so if you had somebody that was going for a job that had 25 years experience in design, or somebody that was fresh out of college, they were more tending to go towards the people with the 25 years experience, understandably. And because of that, I had to think outside the box and think of something different to do. And I then went into working at a small animal hospital. I was a vet tech and I managed a small animal hospital for a few years. Then I went and worked at Educational Testing Services. And there I worked with their computer-based testing. So I worked with the GRE, the GMATs, a lot of other exams that were done by ETS. And then I went into Prudential Insurance and I worked there in year 2000 compliance testing. And while I was both at ETS and Prudential, I went to school at night at Seton Hall Law. And my thought was, oh, well, with my extensive background, both as an artist and also with computers, I'd probably go into more of the technical side in law, maybe go into something like entertainment law or something on that end.
Intellectual but property or something.
Exactly. But when I graduated, I was looking for jobs and just family law seemed to be, for some reason, something that attracted me. And just as I got into it, it seemed to kind of be a natural fit.
Well, you know, I don't think that given your background that it's illogical to conclude that you would end up in family law. I mean, you're dealing with, you know, designing toys, running an animal hospital, and you know, computer testing. I mean, all of that screams family law to me, doesn't it to you?
No, not at all. I mean, it just seemed like very, very odd that it would happen that way. But once I got into it, it just seemed again that, oh, this is exactly what I should be doing. I think when I studied law, in the back of my mind, I always had the thought that I would be helping people and going into something that I would be able to help people. Mm-hmm. And I think family law is just that. It is a job where you're actually helping people. And I think that's, you know, there's this belief that attorneys are actually these horrible people, especially divorce lawyers, were these horrible monsters that are just out to make money and ruin people's lives. But I think when you really study family law and you talk to people who do it, it's actually the opposite. It's actually a bunch of people who are looking to help families to transition from intact families to now two separate households and to be able to move on with their lives in a positive way.
Yeah, you know, being a reformed family law attorney, I can echo that sentiment. You know, the people who gravitate towards and who enjoy family law to me are the ones who do find it, as you say, as a calling to help folks. And the general public, as you said, doesn't seem to view it that way. But people who enjoy the practice certainly do. And I know that, you know, some of the most satisfying days I had in court was when I left knowing that the client that I helped terminate a marriage or resolve a custody issue can now go on with their lives in a grown-up adult way. You know, that was a very satisfying day. Now, it doesn't always end up that way. But when it does, it is satisfying, it is rewarding. You do feel like you've certainly helped people.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things that, you know, when I meet with clients, I'm looking for how can I help them? How can I try to make their lives better? And we all know that when somebody's going through a divorce, it's one of the most traumatic experiences that they could possibly go through. And there's a lot of deep emotional upset. There's a lot of things that are going on. They have a lot of fears. And so it's trying to help them navigate through all that to come, again, to a positive outcome, because nobody wins in a divorce, right? But it's trying to put them into at least a position where they can feel comfortable, they can be happy, their children can be well-adjusted and be able to move forward in a positive light.
You know, and I think so often it's critical how the attorneys approach the task as much as how the clients deal with the issue. Because, you know, we've all had those situations where the attorney on the other side seems to be more involved in the concept of winning than the concept of helping. And that makes for a challenging experience. When you have two attorneys that are both dedicated to assisting their clients get the best out of the situation, the best resolution, you know, it can be a fulfilling experience. And I know, you know, a couple of my best friends in the practice of law are attorneys that I had contentious cases with, frankly, in which I lost both cases, but we're still best of friends. And to me, that's really what the practice of law should be all about.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. And I have found that, yes, I've had some cases where I've had very positive experiences with the other attorney, even though there's been this very adversarial type of atmosphere as far as the clients. I think where family attorneys often get into trouble is where they start to kind of internalize or seem very tied to their client, and they see the problems that their client is experiencing as their own personal problems.
Yeah, they adopt the issue as their own.
Exactly. And that seems to be really a problem that a lot of family attorneys experience. And I think that is the situation that gives us such a negative view by the general public.
Yeah. Do you think sometimes that's a result of attorneys misunderstanding the concept of zealously advocating on behalf of their client? They think in order to do so, they have to adopt the issue that their client faces as their own personal issue?
I think that is some of that. I'm very active in the collaborative divorce community. And so I've dealt with a lot of mental health professionals. And what some of the times I've seen is the coaches will say that they see the attorneys actually, they find some commonality, maybe in an experience they had in their own personal life. And then they make this transference of the feelings that their client is going through. So that sometimes is it too. And I think some of it is just that people just, they want to win. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing for an attorney. Of course, you want your client to have the best possible outcome. But I don't think it should be win at all costs.
Yeah. Well, let's roll the conversation back to you attending law school. I know when I went to the Catholic University of America, not just any Catholic university, but the Catholic University of America Law School, that one of the first questions, literally on the first day of law school, they asked, what practice area do you want to concentrate in? And, you know, I said, you don't have to know that today, but you better know it by the end of the year or the end of the semester. And I don't know too many people who, once they graduated and entered the practice, whether they were doing what they originally set out to do in law school. So you thought that perhaps you might be looking at entertainment law or
intellectual property
or something along those lines. What, and you said you gravitated towards family law. When did that take hold for you? Did you join a family law practice straight out of law school, or how did you transition to that practice area?
Yeah, so when I was in law school, I went to Seton Hall University, and there I focused really on not just taking the core classes, but I took mostly criminal and entertainment law classes, and I actually did a specialization track towards entertainment law because I really thought that was it. I graduated and shortly thereafter, my job at Prudential had ended because year 2000 compliance was now over. It was now 2001. So I was looking at jobs, and as I was looking for employment, I just, for whatever reason, just every time I saw a family law firm looking for an attorney, I said, oh, you know, that might be interesting. Let me try that. And it wasn't something I intended to do. I never took a family law class and school. So I was coming at this, you know, fresh and with no knowledge of what to do. And so my first job was with a family law firm, and I stayed there for 10 years.
Oh, so and you had a good long run with your first.
Yeah, I hate to say it. I think I was there 9 years too long.
Well, we all know that feeling, but go ahead.
You know, there was just some personal things of why I stayed there and why I didn't. But I, in 2010, my mother became very ill, and unfortunately, I lost her then. And that really kind of made me see that I needed to make some changes in my life to kind of put myself in a better position and just be happier with what I was doing. And so it gave me kind of the strength to say, all right, you're miserable at this job. And actually, when I left that firm, I really thought I was going to leave family practice altogether. I thought actually about leaving law altogether. I was contemplating opening a bakery, going back to school and getting my teaching certificate and going to teaching, just anything but law. And then I had a conversation with somebody, and it was that it wasn't I didn't like law or I didn't not like family law. It was I didn't like the way I was working. I didn't like the kind of family law I was practicing.
Today, I'd like to introduce a new sponsor to The Law Entrepreneur, and that's the folks at Jurisdiction. You started your law practice to ditch the firm life and be your own boss, but your practice is running you. The good news, being an attorney entrepreneur doesn't have to be this hard. Jesse and Megan, the lawpreneurs behind Jurisdiction, are working to build a new generation of solo practitioners who love being lawyers. This year, Jurisdiction is introducing a new program, Next Level Law Practice. Next Level Law Practice is a rigorous training program that provides the tools and business fundamentals for estate planning attorneys to start and grow a profitable and streamlined legal business. Next Level Law Practice gives you access to videos, worksheets, templates, one-on-one coaching, and live group sessions that allow you to ask questions and learn on your own schedule. To learn more about the program, visit thrivejd.com. That's thrivejd.com. They're even offering an exclusive coupon code for the Law Entrepreneur listeners. Just enter the code TLE150, that's like the Law Entrepreneur 150, for a $150 discount off your course registration. And welcome to the show, Jurisdiction. This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight, the Mac CRM and case management tool I've been using for years to run my practice. If you want to take your practice further, you need to try Daylight. Daylight keeps track of every case detail and reminds you when you need to follow up so you can focus on what matters most. To be honest with you, I can't imagine running my practice without Daylight. So say hello to a stress-free workflow and visit marketcircle.com to try Daylight now. Remember to mention that you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount off your first monthly subscription. You know, I see a lot of myself in you, in the sense that, you know, I went through a number of different careers before I ended up in law school. And then once I went to law school, I transitioned from three different practice areas, from personal injury to family law to now estate planning. And I think the people who look at themselves and view the world as an opportunity are the ones that move forward. The ones that look at the world and think of it as, woe is me, this is happening to me, I don't know what I'm going to do, are the ones that remain stagnant or regress. So you sound like you're very progressive moving forward here. So here you are, stuck in this practice that you're not enjoying, or this firm that you're not enjoying. And so at that point, you make the decision to do what?
I left there. I made a lot of big life changes then. I moved down to Philadelphia with my husband. I left my practice. I had been there for 10 years. I made these changes. And then what I did for the positive, not only, you know, moving with my husband, but it was, I took mediation training. I studied to become a mediator. Shortly thereafter, I did the training to become a collaborative divorce attorney. And that's when kind of the light came on and said, oh, this is not, it wasn't family law I had a problem with. It was the way it was working. And it was really not, it was thinking more of litigation as an option and the only option, where now it's what is the best way to help my clients to move from their, you know, marriage and the situation they're in to a positive outcome, and what options can I provide them?
I think of that as adding, you know, arrows to your quiver. You know, there are different options that you can afford your client to resolve their issue, whether it be through mediation or the collaborative practice. And I'm familiar with what that is, but explain to our audience briefly how mediation and or collaborative law is different from litigating the issue.
Well, mediation is a process where the parties meet with a neutral party who is, would be myself, and we work together to come to a resolution. So it's about problem solving. It's about how we can get them both to come to a settlement that they're both satisfied with, that they both know that outcome is going to be the best possible outcome for the two of them and their family. It's a non-adversarial process. I mean, yes, the spouses are still have their issues and have their fights against one another.
Still fussing with each other.
Right. But it's circled on trying to, how can we make them be able to uncouple and to be able to move forward in their life in a positive way. I think that mediation is a great way for a lot of people to get divorced. It doesn't work for everybody. There are certain situations where it may not be the right fit. But for those who can do it, they seem to come out of it more satisfied with the results. Because again, it's they had that self-determination. They were able to decide how their family was going to look after they separated. So I really think mediation is a great tool. And it's not the only tool I offer. Like you said, I offer collaborative divorce. So collaborative divorce.
Before we go into collaborative, let me just pontificate a little bit on mediation. When I was doing personal injury law, at least in the District of Columbia, if you take a case and you get into a litigation posture, you filed the lawsuit and you're moving forward, the court requires mediation. It's mandatory. Now, you know, I've gone to mediation, court-ordered mediation, with the idea that there's no way this case is going to settle, and it ends up settling. And I've gone there with, we have a good chance of settling in mediation, and it turns out it doesn't. But the interesting thing is, it's a required activity in such a civil matter. And yet, in the civil practice of family law in the county that I predominantly practice in now, you know, mediation is offered. You know, at your scheduling hearing, the court will ask, Mr. Tyre, do you think mediation is a possibility? And you can say yes or no or maybe or what have you. But it's not required. And I often wondered if that's a mistake on the part of the process, whether or not we ought to at least require an attempt at mediation. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I fully believe that mediation should be tried wherever it's possible. And in fact, in New Jersey, the family courts do have a system in place where if there is an issue with regards to custody, the parties are required to attend parenting time mediation to see if they can resolve those outstanding issues with regards to their custody and parenting time. And then as the parties go through the divorce process before there's a trial, there's also an economic mediation that is required if they're not settled.
All right, so in New
before
Jersey,
that trial date.
So in New Jersey, it is required.
Yes. Okay. That doesn't mean that, you know, in certain counties, they may not push it as much as others. Uh-huh. Where, you know, I could say if I went to certain counties that I can guarantee my clients that they are going to have to attend these mediation sessions. In other counties, the parenting time mediation is still heavily enforced, but the economic mediation may or may not. It may be something more of the attorneys have to bring it up that, oh, well, you know, we're not settled and you're going to be setting a trial date for 2 months from now. Can we just have time to have the parties attend mediation to see if we can resolve these three outstanding issues that we have?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go on to collaborative law then briefly.
Sure. So collaborative divorce is different than mediation in that each party has their own trained attorneys that represent them and they advocate for them. But we still work as an approach of how can we help these parties to resolve their differences, to be able to move forward, to separate in a way that is mindful and thoughtful of how can, you know, what's going to be best for the family. The collaborative process allows us to use other parties to come in and help us. And those people may be a divorce coach, would be a mental health professional to help with the emotional issues. We can also use a financial neutral to assist with valuing businesses, determining budgets, doing looks at what alimony and child support could look like. So we can use these different professionals in that team to try to work out the best possible resolution for everybody. The key with collaborative practice is that the parties have signed an agreement saying that they will not litigate. And it's so it stays out of the court. And that's really key because it gives everybody some kind of skin in the game. They know, okay, we're going to have to try to really work through this process. Because if we don't, we're going to be ending up in litigation. And if you end up in litigation, unfortunately, the parties would have to have new attorneys.
Start all over.
They would,
to a degree.
Yes and no. I mean, there you're not going to necessarily throw out what you've already agreed on.
Right.
But a lot of things are going to be starting over. And so there's a financial risk to it. And there's also a time and emotional risk to it. So I think collaborative practice can work for almost any situation. I really do.
Okay. So there's not a threshold case that you feel is best suited for a collaborative approach?
Best suited? I think parties that have children.
Okay.
That I think that works very well in the collaborative process. The coach can be a wonderful person to not only assist with the emotional issues, but also help with the parenting and custody issues. Mm-hmm. If there's complex financial issues that maybe they want to keep it confidential and private, that's a great tool. You know, collaborative is a great tool to use for a case like that. With senior citizens, because they have unique issues, and graying divorce is a rising thing right now. There's more and more people that are 60 and older who are getting divorced. They also benefit from the collaborative process because, again, they have unique issues with regards to finances because of they may already be in payout status on a retirement plan. They have social security issues. There's other things going on that, again, can benefit from that team approach. So I don't think there's any bad cases necessarily for collaborative, but I think there are certain cases that do tend to do very well in the collaborative process.
Some that are better suited.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about your firm then itself. Now, you're a solo or small firm practitioner. Tell us about your firm.
I am a true solo in that I do everything in my firm. It's just myself right now. I'm actually looking into getting a virtual assistant, but as it stands at the moment, it's myself answering the phones, answering emails, drafting pleadings, you know,
as I like doing to say,
everything.
As I like to say, I'm a three-man firm, me, myself, and I.
Exactly.
So When you started your solo practice, what was your biggest challenge? What was you most afraid of? What were you most afraid of, if I could actually use an English sentence?
The biggest fear I had then is the one I still have today, is it's just how can I keep it going? How can I, you know, make sure that there's enough money coming in to not only pay the bills, but also make it so I'm not working for free. So it's, you know, about how do I get that next client in? You know, I have a case that's settling, or I have a case that's just wrapping up. What can I do to make sure I have that next client coming in to kind of take over for the income stream from that last client?
So what's your typical caseload like? What do you like to maintain?
I don't have a low limit. Like, you know, I don't have a, or I shouldn't say that. I don't have a ceiling. Like, okay. I will take as many clients as I can get in. I haven't had that issue of having to turn clients away. I would love to have that. And it's
a nice problem to have. Yeah.
It's a nice problem to have, but I don't think that that's something that I can't handle. I think that if it gets to the point where it's getting too much, I'm just going to bring somebody else in that I can trust that can help me to kind of get through with those clients. You know, it's trying to get the right mix of different types of clients. My goal is at some point in the future to not be taking litigation cases anymore. Right now, that's not a reality. I just don't see that's a reality in just the marketplace as a whole. I was just going to say, in the past year to 2 years, I've had probably about 50% of my practice has been mediation and collaborative.
Nice.
And so that's a nice blend to have that you know, half ADR and half typical litigation.
Do you do any child advocacy or best interests work?
I do not. I've done some adoptions, and I wish there were more people who were adopting, just because I love that area of practice.
Yeah.
It's one of the few times where everybody walks out of the courtroom smiling.
Yeah, exactly. I'm doing one now, and I'm really thrilled with that because, as you said, you know, everybody's happy when they leave the courtroom.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting,
delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. So how are you physically set up? Do you rent space? Do you work in a virtual space, or are you operating from the kitchen table?
No, I found the first year I was trying to work from home and it just didn't work for me. I'm one of those people that I get very easily distracted. So being home, there was too many other things that, oh, I should do this or I should do that. And that didn't work. So I do have an office space. I'm currently sharing space with another attorney, but I do have my own, you know, private areas. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've been able to create is my own mediation collaborative space. And that's not set up like the typical law office. I just have couches and chairs in there with little tables for, you know, putting down your cup of coffee or your water. There's no big desk in there, and it's very calming. It's in soothing colors. It's, you know, blues and beiges and things like that. And that, I think, is a very helpful space to have, because when I meet with clients for their initial consultation or when I meet with clients for mediated or collaborative work, we have this environment that just kind of seems to be very supportive. The clients don't feel very tense or scared. You know, I can try to lessen some of that fear that they have by just putting them in a more relaxed area. And we can have honest conversations as opposed to more of that strict interview of, oh, when were you married? You know, how much do you make? All that stuff. It can mm-hmm. be more talking about, well, what are your concerns? What would you like your family to look like? You know, things like that. And we can really get on a more deeper level to understand what the client's motivations are and be able to help them to be able to move forward.
What in that environment then, does technology play a role, or are you pretty much bread and butter?
I don't have as much technology as I'd like. And that's one of the things that as my revenue increases, I definitely want to build on. Right now it's, you know, I have the standard law office, you know, copier, computer, you know, that kind of stuff.
How about practice management? Do you use practice management software?
Yes, I do. I use MyCase. Okay. And every time I start thinking, oh, you know, I want to change to another product, they start adding features.
Yeah.
We had
them on the show here. I think it's a great program, and there's a lot of integration that they're offering. They keep adding more and more integration. So, you know, my view is if it's working for you, you know, why change anything?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I talk to other people and they're saying, oh, I use this software or I use this practice management software. And I'm like, oh, okay, let me think about it. And then I look at what MyCase is doing and I'm like, oh, you know, they're really making some great, you know, advancements. They're really doing some more things that they're listening to their clients as to what their needs are. And they're really trying to implement that in there. And, the things they've done with their leads and trying to get more CRM type into there, it's great. And my clients really appreciate that now they can pay their bill right online, right through their portal. It's really good.
Makes your life a little easier too.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What's the biggest headache you have?
The biggest headache I have right now is not having somebody to answer my phone. And that's the one mm-hmm. big thing I'm trying to work on, because I find probably about 50% of my calls are sales calls.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you know that as well.
Yeah. Well, let me just put a plug then in for our sponsor, Call Ruby. You know, I had the same issue and decided long before I just started the podcast, I was a client of Call Ruby, a Ruby receptionist, and they solved that problem for me. Now, they're not the cheapest virtual receptionist that you'll find. There are others out there, but to me, and I say this in all honesty and candor, they're the best. So if that's something you're thinking about in the future, that's a perfect solution, in my humble opinion, to that issue. End of advertisement, so to speak. So how about, you know, as an entrepreneur, I mean, I get the sense from your background that you've always had that kind of entrepreneurial spirit. And is there a particular skill set that you feel supports you best in terms of your entrepreneurial expansion?
I think it's, it's hard to say. I think I did come from a background where I had a family that was very hardworking and really believed in me. So I think that was very important to have that kind of support. But they also believed in that no matter what, you got to push through and you just got to keep working and you just kind of keep at it. And I think that has made me believe that, okay, this month might be a little tighter than I would like. But it's not time to close the doors and do something else. It's time to say, okay, well, what do I need to do to make next month a better month?
Perseverance is an entrepreneurial skill. I mean, if you tuck tail and run and fold up shop at the first, sign of problems, then obviously you're not going to be around very long. And, problems are that opportunity to learn and to grow. So I think most entrepreneurs, have gone through that experience.
Yeah, I think the other thing is just coming from an art background, I think it gives me a different view of the world. It gives me a different way to kind of think outside the box. And I think that's something that sometimes attorneys don't always have is, they say, okay, there's a marital home. It either has to be sold or, one party gets it. And it's like, well, no, maybe there's other options that we can think about. Maybe it's holding onto the house for another 5 years and using it as a stream of rental income.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a elderly parent who's struggling that could utilize, living in that home because it's maybe a rancher and so it'll be better for them. And so keeping the home for them and, maybe somebody else moving into grandmom's house. There may be other options. So it's being open to that kind of different way of thinking and different way of looking at things. And I think that's been very helpful for me, especially in family law, because again, it's not about, a cookie cutter system. Works for one family is not going to work for the next one.
And family law it's a competitive area because there's lots of folks practicing in family law. So, I mean, what are some of the things that you do to market your firm? Are you involved in social media? And to what degree, if you are? And what are your main go-tos in terms of branding your practice?
Well, I had been mostly doing a lot of networking. I've been part of a B&I group and things like that. So that's what I was doing. I was trying to do some social media, and I don't think I was doing it very successfully. And in fact, Neil, one of your other podcast people that you've had on the show, Allison Williams, I went to her retreat a few weeks ago, and that I think really kind of opened my eyes as to how better to do my social media marketing. And so I've really kind of been taking that off and running. And so I've been doing a lot more posting on my social media platforms, posting on different platforms. And in fact, just last night I was at a collaborative law meeting and a couple people said to me, "Oh man, you're really kicking it with the social media. Like you're really, going at it." And I'm like, "Yeah, well, I think I finally got that figured out and it seems to be working." I definitely have gotten more calls, people saying they found me on the internet because of that. So that's a positive thing.
Good.
And I'm really excited about it. And it's, just really trying to, as a solo, I think putting yourself out there and just trying to think as many different ways you can get out there as possible and get your name out there. And I think that's really important. I know some attorneys that say, "Oh, I advertise on Avvo and that's fine." And I'm like, well, that's just one little piece. I think you got to think about, spreading out much further than just one little piece.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer, as is Allison, that you need to go where your clients are. And your clients are on social media. Now, you can pick and choose which platforms you want to spend your time on and how you want to approach it. There's a school of thought that says, you know, I have a business page and a personal page, and I don't mix the two together. Folks like Allison, who, by the way, was on just last week with us, mm-hmm. you know, they're firm believers that, no, I merged the two because that is who I am. My personal life is my business. And so it's a different approach. And it's kind of interesting to see how that plays out for different people. So as we wrap up here, Melissa, you know, one of the things that people tell me they like about the program here, the podcast, is we're not always experts. None of us are experts at this process. We're all learning. That's kind of the reason I started the podcast. And one of the reasons, one of the ways we learn the best is by making mistakes, learning from our mistakes. So I'm going to ask you that question. What was your biggest mistake and what did you learn from it?
I think my biggest mistake is when I started this firm, I was not putting as much money back into building the firm. It was more of, oh, I had a really good month. I'm going to take, you know, a little more in profits this month. And I think that was a big mistake because it didn't help me to build the practice the way I should have. And so now I've kind of reflected on that and said, okay, I really got to focus on building this practice to be what I want it to be, to, you know, grow the way I want to grow.
And interesting.
I think that's something that, again, when you're in law school, they don't teach you how to run a practice.
No, they do not.
And I worked at a firm for 10 years, and I didn't learn, or I was not taught how to run a successful practice. So it's kind of now having to learn it on my own. And like you said, you learn from your mistakes. And I, you know, did some advertising when I first started out that just wasn't working for me. And thankfully, I learned quickly that it wasn't working and didn't sink more money into it than I needed to. But I was just, you know, kind of spinning my wheels and not really making it work. And
boy, if I had all that money that I wasted with all the knowledge that I now have, I'd be kicking, you know, the doors down.
Yeah, you and me both.
For sure. Well, Melissa, it's been a real pleasure having you on the program today. Tell our audience how they can reach out to you if they want to follow up on anything you've discussed today.
Sure. My firm is South Jersey Divorce Solutions, and my website is sjdivorcesolutions.com.
Outstanding. Well, Melissa, I want to thank you again for taking the time to be with us today, and I look forward to seeing you the next time.
Thank you very much, Neil. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
You too.
Well, that will do it for today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I'd like to thank our sponsors for making this show possible, the good folks at Call Ruby Receptionists, Spotlight Branding, Market Circle, the makers of Daylight, and our newest sponsor, Jurisdiction, the providers of the Next Level Law Practice Program. So take a moment to visit our show notes and hop on over to their websites for special discounts and savings and other free stuff that you can get, and just support them because they make this podcast possible day in and day out. Also, if you got a couple minutes, pop on over to our own website, thelawentrepreneur.com. We have a couple little articles there. You can also listen to the podcast itself there if you choose to. And sign up for our newsletter or our mailing list. And we don't do a lot. You know, you're not going to bombard you with emails every week. And I do plan on doing a few more this year, but we'd love to have you join our community. And in that sense, you can also go on to our Facebook page. You can find us just by searching on The Law Entrepreneur. You can find out what we got going on a daily basis, sometimes hourly, on the Facebook page. So I'd love to have you join us there. And if you have the time, last but not least, go on over to iTunes, search on The Law Entrepreneur, and if it's something that you believe in and feel strongly about, we'd love for you to leave an honest 5-star review, as well as comments about what you like and dislike about the show, because it does mean a lot to us that you are our community, our listeners, and I want to thank you for making this all possible. So we'll see you next time on The Law Entrepreneur.